Right, so there's two ways there.
Ladies and gentlemen, today is Monday, March 13th, 2017. I'm opening a meeting of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means Subcommittee on General Government. Today we will be hearing a public hearing on House Bill 5024, the Oregon State Board of Nursing. Mr. Gillibet.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the subcommittee. HB 5024 relates to the Oregon Board of Nursing, State Board of Nursing, excuse me. This is another funds agency. Compared to the legislatively approved budget, the current service level budget is about a 4% increase. It's really just inflation. Board is seeking funds to permanently establish two positions that have already been established on a limited duration basis by the e-board. And here today to present an overview is Ruby Jason, the executive director.
Thank you. Please come on up.
Good morning, Co-Chair Steiner and Co-Chair Rayfield. For the record, my name is Ruby Jason, and I am the Executive Director of the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
For the record, my name is John Etherington. I'm the Licensing and Fiscal Manager at the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Okay. So our slide presentation this morning gives a little bit of an overview of the Board of Nursing, as also an explanation of what the board has been doing over the last biennium and what we intend to do over the next biennium, as well as to explain some of our work elements and our increases in workload. So the board was established in 1911, and our mission is to safeguard the public health and well-being by providing guidance for an entry into the profession, nursing education, continuing safe practice. This biennium, we started the last biennium with three strategic goals, but we are now taking our strategic goals down to only two, and this will be customer service and effective high-quality leadership and governance. The reason we took it down to two is because we are going to be focusing most of our resources on customer service. And our customer is anyone who interacts with the board, including our own internal customers. It's no surprise that at times it is difficult to get a license in Oregon, and we are going to be guiding our resources to trying to make that a little bit easier. These are our board members. Again, they have three-year terms with a possibility of one extension.
Ms. Jason, sorry to interrupt you. Are you going to be giving us a little bit more statistics later on about the timelines for licensure at the moment?
I'm sorry?
Are you giving us a little bit more detail later in your presentation about the guidelines? I mean, the current timeline for
yes.
Licensure?
Yes, we will have that.
Okay, great.
Right. Okay, and our president is currently Colin Hunter, and he is a public member, and he assumed the role in January of 2017, and Bobby Turnipseed, a direct care RN from Ontario, is our president-elect. Okay. So if you can see in these key performance elements, the only key performance element we did not meet in FY 2016 was the key performance indicator for cases being presented to the board in 120 days as required by statute. The statute does allow extensions beyond 120 days, and we have created a policy that we have capped our extensions at 60 days. At 180 days post-complaint receipt, the investigator must present the case to the board, and at that time the board can either make a decision or give guidance to the investigator to continue investigating. But they do go to the board within 180 days. So timely licensure is one that we maintain quite a bit. The measure is taken when all...
Sorry.
So we're going through the key performance measures, looking at the top one, it says percent of complaints referred to the board within 120 days
right.
of receipt. What percent's your target? Where were you? Maybe a little bit more detail on that.
Well, by statute, since it's a statutory requirement, it should be 100%.
Okay. That's okay.
Yeah, it's 100%.
Okay.
And there's just probably no way that could happen. However, since it is in statute, but the statute also allows for extensions. And when I first came to the board in 2014, the extensions were pretty unlimited. I put a cap on that for 60 days, and then the board must see the case. And then the board can say, listen, we have enough. This is what we're going to decide. Or the board is going to say, keep investigating.
Okay. And just to follow up.
Yeah, please. Yeah.
So in 2014 and 15, you hit 100% basically by looking at this chart. And then in 2016, what percent were you at?
We were probably at about 60%. And there was a change in procedure in 2016. Previously, what happened was once the individual licensee was stepped away from practice in on an interim consent order, the case was considered to have gone to the board, but that's not the case because the board has delegated ICOs to board staff. So board staff can get ICOs and then they counted it. So sometimes if they got an ICO right away, the case stopped at 2 days old. And that's not going to the board. I did have conversation with our legal counsel, and he said, absolutely, that's not considered going to the board. So now we have changed our processes. And it will be some time again before we can get to any kind of percentage-wise based on the complexity of the cases, which we will talk about in a little bit.
Okay, so are you proposing that maybe we amend the key performance measure to something that's realistic if 100% isn't realistic?
Yes, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield, we will be doing that. It's not possible to go to 100% based on the new changes that we have in our internal processes, but our internal processes are much more indicative of what we are really doing versus what we'd like to do.
Senator Winters.
Thank you, Madam Chair. How do you plan to do that?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Representative Rayfield and Senator Winters, we will get down to, we are currently collecting data and presenting data to our staff about how many days to the board each individual investigator has. The investigations manager is working with staff that are in the outlier, that are going beyond 180 days. So at first we're going to try to get them down to 180 days and then we'll start whittling it down. But I would say probably we probably go no more than 60% above.
If you can only do 60%, and if this is statutory, so that you're not in violation of the statute, perhaps maybe you might be thinking about a change in the statute.
Well, the statute is not ours, Senator Winters. It's not ours. It belongs to all the healthcare licensing boards. And the way the statute was written, it's 120 days. However, the boards can give extensions, and the extensions are not limited by statute. And so, as I said, when I first got there, the extensions were almost unlimited, and I capped them at 60 days, two 30-day extensions. That's what the statute says. It's 120 days plus 30-day extensions.
And just to clarify for the committee, so I was looking at actually one of the more detailed, the KPM. It's not 100%. It's actually 60% is your target.
Mm-hmm.
And so in this year, in 2016, you were 56% of the 60%. Mm-hmm. So just to make sure that the panel kind of on the dice can take a peek at that, there's further on in the pages that will get into the details.
Yeah, so that makes me
better
aware, if you want to follow up.
No, my apologies, because I have to leave and go to another meeting, but I would like, some clarity, because it's kind of confusing.
Yeah, I'm a little confused, too, because you said...
I misspoke. It's not 100%.
Okay.
It's 60%. That's where the 60 came in my head.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Then let's keep going for the moment, and then we may have other questions as we go along.
All right.
Representative Buehler has a question.
Oh, Representative Buehler, I'm sorry. I didn't see you.
Thank you, Chair Steiner Hayward. What is different about the process that you have to go through that makes it so much more difficult than, say, the Oregon Medical Board, which we saw their presentation, they're able to meet that metric?
Yes, Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield and Representative Buehler. We do not have the same case conclusion types that the medical board has. The medical board can enter into a non-disciplinary agreement with a licensee, whereas we do not have that. I have talked to our legal counsel and proposed that we end up doing something like that because I believe the cases can be much more easily resolved if we allow them to do a non-disciplinary agreement, to take courses, to attend continuing education, those types of things, and we don't have that. We have only dismissal, and then we go to discipline. Mm. And so it does take a little bit of time to get these cases done. The average caseload for my 11 investigators is anywhere from 40 to 50 cases at a time. And of course, we have many contested cases.
Why don't you have that option? What's the barriers
that
to developing?
That was my question, right. So go for it.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield and Representative Bueller, I don't know. I'm still working with our legal counsel to say why can't we do something like that, because I believe that that will allow us to expedite cases, because I believe that most of our licensees would like to have some kind of an option. Most of our licensees, the issues that come to us, particularly the practice ones, aren't always intentional. Some of them are just human error factor, and we would like to offer something. But right now, our legal counsel says that that's not something that they're willing to entertain at this point. So the other thing, too, is we have about 2,200 complaints a year, and the medical board has much less.
Wait, who's not willing to entertain that?
Our legal counsel. I believe our legal counsel has had conversations with the medical board's legal counsel, and it seems to be a double-edged sword for that type of conclusion to a case. But we're still talking. I'm hopeful that we can offer something else besides either dismissal or discipline, something in between for our licensees.
I would recommend maybe you do more than talk and come to some resolution, because this KPM has been below targets for a while, and I think you need to come up with a plan to resolve it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it also seems to me that, I mean, I get that it may be a two-edged sword, although I'm not entirely sure because I've never heard from Ms. Haley that it's a problem from her perspective to have that option. But I can't imagine that having some kind of an intermediate path wouldn't be good for the profession and help you meet your mission better. I mean, I would think that it would be a barrier to self-reporting or to reporting others if you know that the only option is disciplinary proceedings, if there's a problem, when most of them, I would imagine that the vast majority of nurses want to be great nurses.
Yes.
Just like the vast majority of doctors want to be great doctors, and they want to do what they need to do to become great nurses if they're not already great nurses. Mm-hmm. So knowing that you're going to go through disciplinary does not encourage, or that your colleague's going to go through disciplinary automatically, does not encourage people to get the help they need or help others get the help they need.
Right. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield, I agree with you. I think that dismissal or discipline is not a good option. I think that some in-between road where a nurse is required to do some continuing education and show some remediation of their practice and then be allowed to continue with no public discipline on their record. So these conversations that I've had with our legal counsel are a few months old, but I agree with Representative Bueller that we need to solve this, and I don't think that discipline or dismissal are the only should be the only two options.
Okay.
Okay.
And on your other KPMs, I can go down into your appendix, but could you just tell us what the percentages are? Because you do have this down in the appendix. Could you tell us what the percentages are that are your benchmarks for the other KPMs? The reduction of recidivism, customer service, online transactions.
So our current Our current Timely resolution of complaints, we're at 56% with a target of 60%. Reduction of recidivism, our target is 3% and we're at 2%. Our customer service available accuracy is at 93% and a target of 90. Expertise, 91% with a target of 90%. Timeliness, with a 90% with a target of 90%. Helpfulness, target of 90% and an actual of 88%. And availability of information, 86% with a total of with a target of 90, for a total of 90% with a target of a target of 90% with a actual of 89% for all of our KPMs under customer service. Online transactions
not to be difficult, and I get that the vast majority of them you're above target, but then if your overall is below, why is there a check mark in that box?
I think it's because you have to be within 2%.
Oh.
Okay. Before you can say, okay.
Okay, good enough. Online transactions.
All right. The online transactions, it's a little bit of a misnomer because we are not, all of our applications are not online yet. We are trying to get with a vendor so that we can have all of our applications online just like the medical board does. In fact, we've made trips over to the medical board to see how they do that. The only applications that are currently electronic are our renewal applications and our endorsement applications. All the others are still on paper.
And why is the solution that the OMB has? I mean, I'm always reluctant to have people reinvent the wheel, especially when it comes to IT projects. And I get that there are some differences between medical licensure and nursing or CNA, CMA licensure, but essentially you're asking for credentials, you're asking for history.
It's actually the
questions
same.
Are actually identical. So why can the Board of Nursing not just adopt the medical board's solution wholesale?
Because that was done with a private vendor.
But I mean, why can't you just, I guess I'd say you're looking for a vendor, but
we're not represented as Senator Steiner Hayward. We are not looking for a vendor. The individual who programmed our current renewals and our endorsements, we are trying to get back with them in order to continue that and to have all of our license applications online. The Board of Medicine did this quite some time ago, and they have pretty much a closed system where it's a private vendor that they contracted with. Apparently, in the past, boards could do that. They could go with a private vendor, and that vendor would work with just that board. As far as I know, the Board of Medicine is just about the only one that has totally electronic licenses.
Okay, and not to harp on this too much, but based on a fair amount of experience with IT projects over the 5 years I've been in the legislature, I worry a little bit about homegrown solutions that are, as opposed to commercial off-the-shelf system ones that are standardized and that are more, I mean, these days the standard with software and big programs like that mostly is to basically lease commercial off-the-shelf software so that the company maintains it and keeps it up to date so you don't end up in situations where you're running the equivalent of green screens 20 years from now, right? I always say I can't really imagine how interfaces now would be changed, but I'm pretty much sure that they're going to change in the next 20 years because we certainly didn't think 20 years ago that green screens were going to go away. So I don't want you to throw out the work you've done, but I want to make sure that there's a plan in place for making sure that you don't come back to us with a huge fiscal ask in 15 years saying our software is out of date and we don't have the person around who did this. And
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield, the electronic application project is, it's kind of like the porch. You know, you have a house, and the applicants have to get on the porch first and fill out that application. That application then interfaces with our current database in order to collect payment and to process the applications. It's that portal that we are trying to get into our current database. The medical board has a complete project that they did several years ago, or a number of years ago, where they got a specific vendor and they have a standalone system. And so we use CRM, which is a Microsoft product, for all of our data, including our fiscal data, and we are trying to find a porch for the applications to be filled out and then fed into our current database.
Okay.
So we're looking at not a lot of money.
That's a little clearer.
I can't say that in a few years all of that won't be out of date, but I do know that the National Board of National Council of State Boards of Nursing offers for free a nursing licensing database that we are looking at, but that's still 5 years out because other boards of nursing throughout the country are in line for that one, and it's specifically for licensing and fiscal. So and then timely licensing, target is 90%, and we are at 98%. And
I'm sorry, for both new grads and people coming in from out of state?
The way the key measure is when everything has come to us, how long does it take us to issue a license? It's not from the time that they apply to the time that they get issued. All of the data that boards of nursing use is about once all the data comes in, once all the documents are there, how long does it take us to put out that license? And for our renewals, it's less than 2 days. And for our endorsements, it's less than 3 days. Once everything is in, which for endorsements can be quite a wait.
And one of the things we heard from Ms. Haley when she was here talking about the medical board last week was that when they have a physician, for example, who's been licensed in their state, they don't require original diplomas and things like that because those have already been required by the initial state. So the amount of documentation required, de novo documentation that's required for someone who already has an established license in another state is less than for a new graduate, or somebody who's just been getting their training in the state and is getting a license. Is that true also for the Board of Nursing?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield, the answer is no. We require the original graduation because that's required by statute that we assure that the nurse has graduated from a program with a degree based on the licensure that is being applied for. Unlike our physician colleagues, the educational process for nursing is varied.
Sure.
You can have
sure.
a 2-year degree, a 4-year degree, and there's yep. still some hospital schools around.
Yep.
So we have to make sure that if you apply for an RN license, you have been awarded a degree as an RN, and we have to have the original transcripts from the school where they were, or a statement from that state saying at the time they attended, that school was in place, but that school is no longer doing business. And then we have to have a verification from the state where they were originally licensed that they have passed the entry examination. And the entry examination for nursing is a requirement by statute that all licensees have to at least meet the minimum entry requirements, so we have to have that. Then we also, by statute, have to have the verification that they have a clean license without any investigations pending from the last state in which they worked. And unfortunately, if you're from California, that can take anywhere from 6 to 8 weeks to get, because California does not is not a member of the big nurses database. If the nurse comes from a state that's part of the nurses database, it's just a matter of a day or two before we get that verification from the home state. So there's a lot of moving parts. I did look a year ago about trying to make endorsements a lot easier, because endorsements are really the and you'll see later in the slides, you can see the exponential increase of our endorsements. We are currently receiving anywhere from 400 to 480 endorsement applications per month. And that is a lot. And it's overwhelming the staff because of all of the moving parts. And then, of course, we also have to have fingerprint criminal background checks. So it is a very cumbersome process to endorse someone into the state. I did present to the board all of the moving parts. And I guess one of the questions that the board had at that time was, what part can we eliminate to keep it safe? Because, again, there are states that still will allow nurses to grandfather in. If they don't have the right education based upon their years of experience. So, again, unlike our physician colleagues, it's not the same nationwide. There's no GME that really contributes to this is what medical education is supposed to look like.
Okay. Thank you for your patience with all my questions.
Oh, no. Okay. This is the agency overview. This is our organizational chart. As of the 13-15 biennium, we have combined the management of the licensing and fiscal under one manager, which is John over here to my left. Our database tracks payments with applications, and this allows one manager to oversee the process of all the money coming in and one manager to oversee the process of all the money going out. So there's that check and balance there. And, of course, I'm ultimately responsible for the fiscal health and strategic plan of the agency. Go ahead, John. These are our FTEs. You can see that there has not been significant changes since 2009. We have a few more FTEs, but, again, not significantly more. The organization has stayed pretty steady. Okay, our number of licensees. These are the licensing numbers as of March 2017. Registered nurses and licensed practical nurses make up a total of 62,969 licensees, while certified nursing assistants make up 18,648. The total licenses that the agency manages is 87,507. All NPs, clinical nurse specialists, certified registered nurses, nurse anesthetists, they all have RN licenses in addition to their advanced certification or licensure, and certified medication aides must have a CNA in order to be a medication aide. Therefore, those 87,507 licenses actually represent 81,786 individuals. As you can see, the graph shows the number of new applications has increased dramatically from FY 2015 to FY 2016. The graph shows a 10% increase. While it is difficult to determine the cause for this increase, we have noted there has been an increase in licenses from out-of-state nurses who must have an Oregon license in order to perform case management and other services enhanced by the Affordable Care Act. Although these nurses are licensed in the state where they live, they may also have many licenses from different states, since each state has jurisdiction over the health care provided to its citizens. So you have nurses that have 20, 30 licenses that work for these managed care companies. Another increase is the number of foreign applicants, both those who intend to practice in Oregon and those who will never practice in Oregon. In some countries, particularly the Philippines, having a license issued by a U.S. state will allow the nurse to be considered for the best jobs in the best hospitals in their country. We are also seeing an increase in advanced practice license applications, which we can discuss later when we look at that slide. Oregon nurses and certified nursing assistants renew on a two-year cycle, so these numbers may be a little bit misleading with the number of renewals. Nurses born in an odd year renew in an odd year, and nurses born in an even year renew in an even year. So according to this graph, we have many more nurses born in an odd year than an even year. As you can also see, this trend is a little bit new. We will be, one of the questions we would like to answer this biennium is how many nurses do not renew their Oregon license during the first, second, or third renewal cycle. Continuing to see increases in licensing may be a single data point, but another more important data point may be how many nurses keep their Oregon license to, again, to a one, two, or three renewal cycles.
I agree that that's a really interesting and important question, and if the answer is a much smaller number than you would anticipate, mm-hmm. be very interesting to understand why.
Yes.
So you guys don't do exit interviews, as it were, exit surveys, but you know who's supposed to be renewing.
We know who's supposed to be renewing, but we don't have that We have not gone into that in-depth study yet, but that's one of the, when I saw this slide, when we were putting it together, I questioned the same thing. We were seeing many more licensees, but how many of them are actually keeping their license? And how many continue to intend to work in Oregon, or are they just maintaining their license and are never going to be working here? We do know that when we do the calculations for the HPSP program, we take only nurses, RNs, and LPNs who have Oregon addresses. And at last count, which was last biennium, I have not looked at this number recently, we had about 48,000 nurses who had addresses in Oregon.
So you've got 81,000 licensees?
Well, that number, Senator Steiner Hayward, that might be a little bit of an older number, but that's the last time I looked at it. And when I saw this slide, I thought, we need to look at this.
Yeah, could you follow up with the committee with that number, please?
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Absolutely. Okay, John.
Because I would guess, I mean, I don't know this for a fact, but I would guess that is not the case for the medical board, for example, mm-hmm. or the board of dentistry. And if so, I'd like to understand a little bit more about why. I mean, I hear what you're saying about the traveling nurses and, you know, people who are going back to their home countries and that kind of thing. That's a little bit different, but that does seem like a huge discrepancy. So I'd like to say a little more.
So this is endorsements received. An endorsement of a license is done when a nurse or certified nursing assistant is already licensed in another state and wants a license in Oregon. And we already talked about the endorsement licensing, which is a lengthy process that is required by statute and rule. If everything comes back electronically, if everything is the nurse is on top of it and gets all their documents in, the process could take as little as 3 to 4 weeks. But if the nurse has either difficulty getting their documents or has some kind of a delay, such as a positive criminal record, it could take a few months. Once the nurse is given an Oregon license, they are no longer an endorsed license. They are now counted as an Oregon licensee, even if they never work in this state, and their license renewal will simply be categorized as a renewal. Our investigations are slowly increasing after a significant dip in 2014. That's not a slide you really want to. That's not a number you really want to go up, but it is going up. As represented when we presented in April, we are seeing cases of greater complexity and increasing cases associated with the opioid issue. We see cases where the practitioner either has not prescribed or has not had adequate documentation for prescribing, or complaints from patients who have been on opioids for many years with a previous practitioner and are now being weaned off their opioids per CDC and Oregon guidelines. We have met with the medical board and have agreed that the Board of Nursing and the Board of Medicine need to join forces in encouraging our prescribers to review the Oregon guidelines for opioid prescribing guidelines and coming out with a joint statement to all prescribers, encourage them to follow the guidelines. Both boards do acknowledge that prescribers are both in a prime position to assist in this issue, but are also caught between the demands of their patients, satisfaction scores of their organizations, which may be tied to compensation, and the public's lack of knowledge about long-term effects of these drugs.
Yeah, Dr. Rickel.
You got 2,111 complaints and 49 people to investigate those complaints. How the heck do you investigate 2,111 complaints in a year with 49 people? I'm assuming not all 49 people are going to be investigating the complaints.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield, we don't have 49 investigators. What we have is right. 11 investigators.
Right, and so you have 49 FTEs, so you have 11 right. investigators. How do so that emphasizes the point even more. How do 11 people investigate 2,111 complaints in a given year?
Some of those cases are criminal background check, which require very little work. Basically, what happens is if someone says, yes, I was arrested for shoplifting 3 years ago, 4 years ago, that goes over to investigations. And we have two investigators who do the lighter cases. And what they do is they ask for court documents. And if the court documents show that the individual's sentence has been carried out or they were found not guilty, they write a very short report to the board, and then the board authorizes them to either get licensed or they dismiss the case if they're already a licensee. So only 27% of our cases are actual practice cases.
That's helpful.
Most of our and those practice cases are the lengthiest, more complex cases. Yeah. Most of our cases are either impairment, diversion of drugs, or criminal background check. So of our 11 investigators, four of them are registered nurses, and they do the practice cases. The other seven are non-nurses who are investigators with the state, and they do all of the non-practice cases, which, again, is significantly more than the practice cases.
That's very helpful. Thank you.
Could you give us a breakdown on those 2,100 complaints? I mean, I'd like to see a little bit more detail on those to understand the scope of the problem. I mean, you just said some of it out loud, but I'd like to see something on paper that's, or the electronic yes. equivalent of paper, with a little bit more detail. You know, how many of them are just criminal background checks that get resolved in a matter of days? How many of them are actual? That 27%, what does that breakdown look like? Within that 27%.
Yes. Senator Steiner Hayward and Representative Rayfield, we actually this last year joined the TRCAP program, which is a national database of practice breakdown cases. So we do keep records of what kind of practice breakdown nurses have, and we would be very happy to give the committee this information.
That would be helpful, and since you're part of that national database, I assume you have data on national averages?
Yes, we do.
Like to see those as well, please. Thank you. Representative Alonso Leon.
Yeah, just staying on this topic, just curious, how long does an investigation take for a practice case?
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, and Representative Alonso Leon, it depends. We have some cases that go on for quite some time. First of all, what we have to do is, because we have subpoena power and we are HIPAA exempt, we get the medical records of the patient. We see what's in the medical records, and I don't know if any of you have had the privilege of printing out electronic documents from medical records these days, since this is mostly an Epic town, and Epic is a very popular program. It's reams and reams and reams of paper. We are also now asking the hospitals to put them on a disk so we can just review them. It depends on how long medical records are. We also get the personnel records of the individual to see if they've ever been counseled. In September of this last year, we do have a new tool that the board has endorsed called the Complaint Evaluation Tool, and it is mostly for practice breakdown issues, and it guides managers as to whether or not the case is reportable to the board. We are hoping that that will decrease the number of complaints that are really never should have gone to the board. But it could take, depending on if the individual says, yes, I did this, and I'm really sorry, it could go to the board within a month, but if it goes on, it could go into the board again. Our goal is 120 days with two extensions. Within 6 months, it has to go to the board. So there are some that keep going on because either the licensee now has attorney representation and they drag it out, or the individual is reticent in providing us information, or we need them to get a mental health or a chemical dependency evaluation, and those take quite a while. So it depends on each case.
Thanks. Okay.
Okay. All right, number of licensees. As you can see, the numbers of licensees continue to increase, and I previously have discussed some of the reasons for this. The National Council on State Boards of Nursing, through a review of the nurses database, has calculated that the number of nurses per 100,000 residents in Oregon is 800 to 900 nurses per 100,000. If you compare that to California, California has 600 to 700 nurses per 100,000, and Washington State has 700 to 800 nurses per 100,000. Again, this is the total number of licensees in Oregon, regardless of whether they're currently practicing in Oregon or not.
I'm sorry, you speak faster than I can type.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I know, it's okay, but I want to make sure I get this right. So Oregon is 800 to 900 nurses per 100,000 residents. California is what?
600 to 700.
Okay.
Nurses per 100,000. and Washington has 700 to 800 nurses per 100,000. I just looked at the West Coast.
Thank you. That's fine.
Okay. The Oregon Center for Nurses.
I'm sorry, but so why do we think that is?
Why do we think that is?
Yeah.
I haven't really looked at that data. I don't know why that is. Oregon is not a very populous state compared to California. And even though California has almost 250,000 nurses, they still end up, because of the population of their state, as 600 to 700, but I have not reviewed that data.
Okay. Thank you.
The Oregon Center for Nursing has determined through their work that the issue of the perceived nursing shortage is due to a maldistribution of nursing resources, with the I-5 corridor having the most licensees and rural areas having the fewest. There's also a lack of nursing resources for long-term care facilities, nursing homes, and in community-based settings. There is great concern in the community regarding the shortage of faculty to teach future nurses, and as the current faculty retires, schools of nursing will find it harder to recruit qualified faculty for positions. So even though our numbers keep going up, 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 the perception of a nursing shortage does not go away, because it depends on whether or not you have a nurse at the bedside at the time when you need them. And we are hearing from our colleagues in long-term care and in nursing home care that sometimes it's one nurse for the entire facility, and it's very, very concerning for them.
Representative Bueller.
Yeah, thank you, Chair.
And then Representative Alonso Leon.
So this is a big problem in lots of areas in Oregon. Have you come up with an action plan to address this nursing shortage?
Senator Steiner Hayward and Representative Rayfield, Representative Bueller, the Oregon Center for Nursing, we are meeting with them regularly because they are the data people for nursing. And we do agree with them that it is a maldistribution of nursing, particularly in the rural areas. So I don't know how the Board of Nursing can encourage nurses to work in rural areas versus the comparative salaries that are along the I-5 corridor. What we have seen and what the Oregon Center for Nursing has seen is that when nurses get a little older, they move back home and they take their families with them, and that's really what you see in the rural areas. So it is a matter of where people choose to live. There is a new nursing program in Klamath Falls that was a joint effort between the local school there and the hospital, Sky Lakes Hospital, to try and keep nurses in the local community, but they are also finding that once these nurses graduate from their program, they will move to where the salaries are a little bit more lucrative and where their abilities to find jobs, or I'm sorry, where their abilities to find the kind of nursing that they want to do is greater. So maybe in a few years, when the baby boomers like me retire, there will be a absolute nursing shortage, but right now it's considered a maldistribution of nursing resources.
I know you two have questions. I want to follow up, if I could, first on the answer to Representative Bueller's question. So 23 years ago, there was a family medicine residency also established in Klamath Falls with the goal of providing more family physicians for rural areas. They have been pretty successful. 80% of their graduates practice in areas considered, or more, practice in areas that are considered rural. And part of that, obviously, has to do with the fact that compared to most family medicine residencies, they're in a more rural location, whereas for nursing school, it's not quite the same. But do you have any sense of what that program's in medicine, we know that, generally speaking, if you take someone who grew up in a rural community and you train them to become a physician, they're more likely to practice in a rural community. I would guess that that would be true for nurses as well, but apparently not, by the way you're shaking your head?
No. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward and Co-Chair Rayfield, no, that is not the case for nurses. You have younger people. They get their licenses a lot younger than our physician colleagues, and they want to go, a lot of them will want to go to the big city. Now, they do tend to drift back home later on, you know, once they've seen the lights of the big city, then they go back home. However, I think one of the main differences is that physicians are usually self-employed. They have their own practice, whereas nurses usually work for an organization, and they may not be very happy with the benefits that their organization pays, the salaries that their organization pays, and they go looking for something else. So really, it's the situation where nurses are not independent practitioners. They are usually dependent practitioners based on, you know, what kind of benefits they can get and what kind of salary they can get and what kind of overtime they can get.
Yeah, that issue of self-employment is less common today than it was before, but I take your point. Representative Alonso Leon.
Yeah, so education and workforce is really important to me, and I'm just wondering, similar question to Representative Buehler, and what way are you working with our education system to create opportunities for an issue that you mentioned, where we don't have enough nurse educators? That is, and I hear it also. I hear it also. And so I guess I want to hear what your strategic plan is around that, education and marketing around recruiting more people to be nurses. I know that our education system, some institutions have a lottery system to accept students into the nursing programs. So I'm just wondering, what your plans are.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, and Representative Lozano Leon. It is the intent of the Board of Nursing to make sure that the faculty are qualified. That said, the current qualifications for being on faculty in a nursing program may have some nurses not able to enter those professions. So we are going to be looking at some of that. One of the programs that is currently being looked at is a having the nurses at the bedside be assistants to the nursing faculty. We currently have a 1-to-8 nurse to student to faculty ratio, which, again, that's not a lot of students per faculty member. I believe the bigger issue is within the organization, within the schools, being able to fill positions at the salary. Again, you come down to salary. I'll give you an example of my own. When I was ready to leave my position at Dornbecker, I did look at being a nurse educator, and it was almost a $100,000 a year pay cut. It's a lot of money that you can make in the acute care facilities, and nurse educators usually become nurse educators towards the end of their career, and because they don't want to do the nursing anymore, and they want to go ahead and do faculty, and a lot of them want to pass on their knowledge to the next generation of nurses. But right now, there's not any kind of compensation that will be able to be made. But I do know that we have a education advisory committee, which is made up of all the deans of all the schools of nursing in the state, and they meet on a regular basis, and they are actually looking at issues like lack of clinical placements. When you are looking at a nursing unit that has 6 or 7 nurses on staff, and you've got, you know, 4 and 5 nursing students you have to deal with, plus new orientees, it's quite a burden on the nursing staff. So it's a multifaceted problem that I do not have an answer for, and I don't think the board has one either. I do know that we are working with the OCN, the Oregon Center for Nursing, to try and find something, because this is a huge issue, and it's a huge issue around the country for aging faculty.
Representative Malmstrom and then Representative Buehler.
Do you have information about the nurse faculty loan repayment?
No, Representative Malmstrom, I do not.
Okay. Let me clarify your question, because I want to understand. Are you saying that there's a separate loan repayment program, or there should be a separate loan repayment program?
Well, we have a bill coming out, and also, you know, there's been things in the past, and I know the medical board does things like that, too. I'm wondering if that could be part of the solution to incentivize nurses to go into the profession if there was a loan repayment program.
Yes. Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, and Representative Malmstrom. I believe at one time before my time with the board, there was a loan repayment program. I think that was now no funds for that one.
Right.
Yes, that could help, a loan repayment program. Or for the rural areas, I know when I got out of nursing school, I worked in a underserved federal area, and all of my loans were repaid. So, you know, if we can get some of these rural areas like Klamath Falls or some areas to be considered underserved and that their loans would be repaid back, that could be a possible solution. But that would take funding.
Right. There are at least two other bills, Representative, right, about healthcare workforce providers, and there's a new, right, one to set up my bill, but it's in the House because it's Interior, right, Revenue Bill, right, that we've talked about. That's it's a committee bill in House about setting up a workforce training trust fund that would actually include the possibility of augmenting salaries to help attract qualified faculty. Right.
That's
Representative Buehler.
What bill number is that?
I'll look it up because it just got, it's a House bill.
Okay.
I don't have enough. Yeah, thank you, Chair. You know, I work with nurses and CNAs frequently, and I hear complaints from many, many of them about, especially from CNAs who strive to become RNs and go through the training, and it's just not available in Oregon. And when I've gone into that problem even deeper, it's a shortage of nurse faculty. You hear it, I hear it. You have deans of nursing schools on your committees that are talking about this issue. I'd love to see a proposal come forward to resolve this problem. And if you need the active engagement of the legislature, so be it. I'm more than willing to work on it. But I've been hearing this for almost a decade,
yeah,
now. And it's time to stop talking about some of these problems and actually bring some solutions forward. They don't have to be perfect, but we need to start moving the problems off the table and solving them. Especially when there's tons of young nurses who really want to strive and move from that CNA role into the full nursing role, and there's jobs out there, mm-hmm, many jobs in rural areas. You know, it's really time to solve this problem.
House Bill 3085.
Thank you. Yep. All right. As you can see by the slide, the second line is a decrease in the number of certified nursing assistants. As healthcare moves more into the community setting, the population that we draw from to be CNAs, that healthcare worker class previously applying for certification can now find comparable wage jobs in those settings where outside of a nursing home and long-term care facility, they don't require certification. While this does speak to more community access, it also means less education, less accountability, and most importantly, a lack of recourse for the public if there is a care issue. So what we are finding is that as the community health worker moves in and as a care, again, goes out into the communities, certified nursing assistants are not necessary. You can have a lay healthcare worker that doesn't require any certification and pay almost as much as a CNA. Why bother with certification and keeping that up and paying the licensing fees if you can make just as much money working in the community and not having to do any of that? So we are seeing a little bit of that movement. The advanced practice licenses, while not appearing to have a significant increase per this graph, have actually experienced a 15% growth rate this biennium compared to a 6% growth rate in 2013-15. We're not sure if this trend will continue as the healthcare landscape continues to change. However, given Oregon's longstanding independent practice for certain advanced practice nurses, we are likely to see this trend continue or stabilize, but there's no prediction that it's going to be a decrease.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the 17-19...
Can you just introduce yourself for the record, please?
Thank you.
Thank you.
My name is John Etherington. I'm the Licensing and Fiscal Manager for the Oregon State Board of Nursing.
Thank you.
Co-Chair Steiner Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, members of the committee. For the 17-19 biennium for the governor's budget, we are asking for for our revenue, it is going to be $16,621,964. Out of our revenue, 7% is our net transfer to the DHS, which is our CNA, CMA federal program. That amounts to a little bit over $1 million. The other funds that we collect through licensing fees and other revenue will be $15,532,915, which is 93% of our budget. For our expenditures for the 17-19 biennium, we are asking for $16,938,043. Of this, we have 3% as a distribution to a nonprofit agency that was legislative in statute. We have 6.3 million for our services and supplies. This includes our HPSP program, which is 37% of our budget, and the personal services is 10,091,715, which is 60% of our biennium.
Representative Rainville. So just a quick question. So it looks like your ending fund balance increased by $1 million over the last biennium, and then this biennium you're planning to, I mean, basically expend more than your revenue by about, was that about $300,000 or so? And I'm just kind of curious what, you know, what the drastic swing was where you were plus $1 million in the latter biennium and now we're short $300,000.
Part of this governor's budget, Co-Chair Rayfield, is a little misleading because of the revenue part. We haven't added the $500,000, and this was particularly an oversight because of this new statute and how we've been instructed from our CFO is to wait for these changes till we go through.
So blame him. Can I blame him? Is that okay?
You can blame me. I mean, it was really my oversight with the new statute. So going back to that revenue slide, if we were to add that $500,000 in, we'd be over $17 million,
okay,
which would be
sense.
More of our expenditures,
okay,
because our expenditures does have that $500,000 increase. But going before to your case, before that, we're able to save some money each biennium. We're not spending our full amount of expenditures. So in the previous bienniums, we have been able to save money through our expenditures by not spending the full amount, which has increased our bottom line ending balance.
Thank you.
Okay. Our accomplishments during this last fiscal year, we have increased training opportunities for staff and updated staff job classifications. As I've said before, when I first got to the agency, the jobs, descriptions and the work the staff actually did were misaligned, and we have spent the last few years doing desk audits of each and every employee and making sure that they are adequately compensated for the work that they do. We have implemented a electronic performance management system. It's an off-the-shelf performance management system. It's cloud-based, and it allows us to put the job descriptions into the actual performance evaluation so that individuals will be judged on their performance to their job, and also to make sure that our strategic plans are also part of their performance. That system will be eliminated once the HRIS system comes online and has the capability of electronic performance management. It was a relatively inexpensive off-the-shelf program, but we felt it was important to go electronic rather than the old paper system. Also, we have enhanced our board member orientation program. In addition to the program that's required by the governor's office, we also have a nursing board-specific orientation program that our board members have found extremely helpful. We converted licensee practice policies to interpretive guidelines, and while this may not seem like a big thing, licensees were previously confused by the nomenclature of policies on our website. Again, since most nurses are employees of organizations, a policy is something you had to do, and they frequently mistook our policies online with the Nurse Practice Act, and policies online are not the Nurse Practice Act. That's only statute and rule. So what was happening was organizations were saying, you know, it's against the Nurse Practice Act for you not to abide by this policy, and that's really not the case. So we have eliminated that policy nomenclature. Some of those policies did have words like shall and must, and we've just eliminated all of that. The Nurse Practice Act consists of statutes and rules, not policies, and policies cannot be used to determine license discipline. Taking an example from our medical board, we have taken down the policies and made interpretive statements outlining the board's interpretation of the Nurse Practice Act regarding certain procedures, roles, and activities. The Board of Medicine has guidelines, and we have interpretive statements. All interpretive statements are board approved, and even though, again, it's feels like a small change, it has a significant issue for our licensees. Also, we proposed this year, we have several bills moving forward, and all of those are just to update outdated statutory language, like postmark by midnight, and, you know, there is no temporary licensure in Oregon because the ability to get your results back from your nursing entry license exam is just a day or two. So we had to clean that all up. We installed a new phone system, which is quite the feat with the new phone system. But that is also allowing us to have our staff telecommute. Qualified staff can telecommute one day a week, and we are going to be using the new telephone system to do a voice over IP through their laptops. And that will allow them to make phone calls to their licensees without disclosing their own private phone number. Let's see. We also have implemented online status reports, and this has been very popular with our applicants and our investigations. So an individual can actually go online and say, okay, what's still missing from my licensing? Is it, do I need my transcript still? Do I need my criminal background check? And it will allow them to know exactly where they are in the licensing process. And also for investigations, because there is a lot of confusion about where I stand in my investigations, the licensee can also say, okay, the report is finished, it's going to the board in April, and the board will decide in April what's going to happen. So that does give them some information. And we also have updated our public records request procedures based on statewide efforts to improve public records request turnaround time.
Hang tight. Representative Malmstrom.
One thing that I thought was a really great improvement was this online report, because I'm a registered nurse, and it used to be that every 2 years I had to bother you to get me, you know, verification that I still was current my license, and then I had to go back to my employer who bugged me to say, prove to me you're still, you know, licensed, and it was all this hassle. Now my employer just goes to the database, checks, and I'm out of the loop completely, so I don't have to be messing with that. So that was a really great efficiency.
Thank you. We appreciate that. Okay. And here's my contact information and John's contact information, and I'll be happy to answer any more questions based on the continuing report on our on the appendices. Okay. Unless you would like me to go over all the appendices.
No, I do not.
Co-Chair Sammy Hayward, Co-Chair Ray Field, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Anthony Medina, and I'm an analyst in the Chief Financial Office. Today, I'll be going over the governor's recommended budget for the Oregon State Board of Nursing. The core mission of the agency revolves around keeping Oregonians safe and regulating the practice of nursing. An emerging issue for the agency that Ruby Jason earlier discussed is the statewide shortage of nursing, particularly around rural communities. The governor's budget maintains existing programs and adds modest increments to the budget. Here's a graph of the agency's expenditure histories over time. And here are the agency's expenditures broken down by category. This breakdown is should be considered standard for regulatory agencies, and 2/3 to 1/3 between personal services and service and supplies. And here's the agency's history for revenue. For at the end of 2017-18, the agency should have roughly 5 months ending balance. The governor's budget maintains existing services and supports the May 2016 Emergency Board, with addition to statewide addition to the updates in DAS price list and state government service charges. with that concludes my presentation, and I can answer any questions the committee might have for me.
Representative Rayfield.
I was looking at the 15-17 legislatively approved business licenses and fees versus the governor's budget would basically say the $13.8 million, and then you have the increasing, the increasing total of licenses each year. So we expect it to be exactly the same, the 13.8, or will that increase this year or this biennium?
Co-Chair Rayfield, that's a great question. Earlier, John mentioned the $500,000 difference that I didn't include in their budget. Because of timing issues when the governor's budget goes to print, the $500,000 got mixed up. However, revenues are generally, they're not static. They can be updated at any time, at least during the biennia. So it's just something that could get corrected. But in terms of just timelines when the governor's budget goes to print, it didn't get included.
So the $500,000 is the increase in licenses that we'll expect to see in the next
biennia. Associated with an increase in licensees.
Okay.
Correct.
Perfect. Thank you.
So, Ms. Jason, I'm confused about something. The 11 investigators you mentioned, that includes the one you got last May with eBoard?
Yes. Co-Chair Snyder-Hayward, yes.
But you didn't ask for another one for this upcoming biennium? You just asked for a roll-up of the new one you got last year?
Yes.
Even based on the increased investigations, complaints, and the concerns about the depth of these with the opiate?
Co-Chair Snyder-Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, again, as I previously said, we are seeing an increase in non-practice type issues.
Okay.
We are carefully watching, particularly the increase in complaints about the opioid issue. And, we may be back in front of the e-board sometime this biennium to correct some of that. Because right now, I don't believe I can justify having another investigator. Again, their caseload, when you look at Washington State, their investigators carry a caseload of about 70 cases, and we carry 40 some odd cases. And I purposely are wanting to keep it that way.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. I'm Ms. Rumer. Representative Malmstrom.
Well, another question I had about that is if you have a significant chunk of people who get a license here but never practice here, then those people aren't going to be getting investigated. So how does that all figure into that?
Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, and Representative Malmstrom. Because nursing is nationally linked with a database, we know if a nurse is licensed in Oregon, whether or not they've been disciplined in, say, Montana. And then we will look at the issue from Montana and investigate the nurse. Even though the nurse is not working in Oregon, we still have jurisdiction over their license. So if, for example, Montana says, well, you can't work here anymore, we want to make sure they don't come over to Oregon and they don't go state hopping. And so with the database that links all 59 boards of nursing that are in this country, even though there are only 50 states, but there are 59 boards of nursing, it is very easy to see. And we have investigated a number of nurses who don't live in Oregon but were disciplined in another state.
Okay.
Because it was egregious enough that we probably want to look into that.
Yeah, just a quick question. It looks like you mentioned that you reclassified positions and probably analyzed if you were at capacity or needed to increase your capacity. And it looks like there's an ask for two additional positions to the 49, so then that would bring you up to 51 potentially in the near future.
Co-Chair Steiner-Hayward, Co-Chair Rayfield, and Representative Alonzo Leon, no. That is, that we asked for with the e-board back in May.
Okay.
And I believe that the roll-up of FTEs is inclusive of that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, we're not asking for anything above what we've already received.
Got it. Thanks.
Great. Any other questions?
Ms. Strella, about anything else you want to add?
Okay, then we got one person signed up for public testimony. Susan King, come on up.
Maybe I think it's 2000. I'm still in 2006.
I Good morning, Senator Steiner Hayward, Representative Rayfield, and members of the committee. My name is Susan King. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Nurses Association. I did have the pleasure a number of years ago to spend 6 years as a member of the Board of Nursing. So I am here today to testify in support of the board's budget. I would like to call out some specifics, but before I do, I think Ms. Jason talked about the first licensure regulations that occurred in 1911, and my organization was actually founded to achieve that. So we were founded in 1904, and it took us till 1911 to get the first license act. So we feel very much a partner with the Board of Nursing. I'd like to just call out a couple of specifics for you. We are very interested in an intermediate approach between revocation and discipline for those cases where there is a question whether there's truly a statutory or rule violation. We do also support that licensees get information about the process and where they are in the process, whether it's a disciplinary process or an endorsement process. As you might imagine, any licensee that is facing discipline by their licensing board is under a great deal of strain, pressure, loss of a career, loss of income, and so the black hole, if you will, that used to exist where the licensee had no idea when something might happen or what might happen is certainly something that we believe should be remedied, and we appreciate the fact that the board is working on that. We have in the past and continue to support making the endorsement process more efficient as long as we can rely on consistent standards and that it doesn't jeopardize public safety. And so we have expressed our support and will continue to be willing to work with the board to see what we can do to improve that process. Finally, we very much support the use of a tool that guides the decision-making for someone who is contemplating making a complaint to the board. Having been both a Board of Nursing member and an administrator of an advocacy organization, I know that there are cases. Can I give you a percentage? No. There are cases, and I would say many of them, many cases, where an employer has attempted to use the Board of Nursing as a threat in what really is an employee-employer issue. And so having any kind of guidance from the board about what it might consider to be truly a violation of the Practice Act, statute, and rules, I think would be a benefit. And actually, one more point. I do want to acknowledge that the nursing shortage and nursing workforce issues have been front of mind for most of us for a very long time. I've lived through at least three crises within the nursing profession, and we have, in fact, made multiple attempts, as you have discussed, to try to get at some of the causes of this shortage. With respect to faculty, I think it was clearly articulated the effect of compensation on someone's willingness to be a faculty member. Were I to leave my clinical practice, which is in a large ER here in Portland, I would take probably a 40% reduction in compensation. And I think very few individuals, my profession or any other, are willing to do that. Some of the other issues are that we have a proliferation of schools of nursing, and some have failed, as you all know. And so I think we have to be careful about approving schools of nursing where we don't have sufficient infrastructure or resources. The clinical site issue is critical, and we did, when I was a member of the board of the Center for Nursing, we did have a electronic format to try to match the clinical site requests from various schools of nursing with the availability across our health system, and unfortunately that wasn't completely supported by either academia or the health systems and could have been a good tool. Finally, I think workload for faculty in separation from the compensation issue, the workload for faculty is really critical. We have done a number of things in this state. Representative Malmstrom has indicated the Faculty Loan Repayment Program, which my organization helped to establish, is one piece of a very complex puzzle. But helping someone obtain the necessary credentials, education and credentials, and then bringing them into a practice where their compensation and their workload are unsatisfactory is not a complete solution. So we are, as an organization, continually looking for ways to ensure that we have an adequate workforce, both across the practice settings, what makes nurses stay, enter the profession and stay, and there's a lot that could be discussed that we don't have time for today. But I do think there have been very significant efforts made to try to get at the nursing workforce and particularly the faculty issue that have not all been successful, but I just want to acknowledge that we are still working on it and willing to work further on it. So I thank you for your time, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Ms. King, can you circle back for a minute about this issue about employer-employee issues in the practice set? Can you help me understand that issue a little bit more, please?
Yes, Senator Steiner-Hayward and Representative Rayfield. The point I was making is that, and I think it was articulated by the Board of Nursing, is that most nurses, not all, but most nurses are employees and therefore are subject to the employer's policies, the employer's interests. And there have been occasions, I'm very well aware, both in my tenure on the Board of Nursing and in my role now as the Executive Director, where an employer, in order to achieve an outcome, which may be that they wish to terminate for one reason or the other, not necessarily a violation of the Practice Act, or they wish to impose some work plan on a nurse, or they have other reasons, they attempt to use the board as a threat. Please do this, or we're expecting you to do this, or we will report you to the board. And in my organization, because we are also a labor organization, we know a great deal about those cases. And when those cases come to me for review, because I am part of the registered nurse workforce in my own organization, my first question is, if that is being said, what element of the Nurse Practice Act, statute, or rules is alleged to be violated? Because often it isn't. And so we very much appreciate the fact that the board is trying to offer some guidance about what really would constitute a violation of the public safety concept in the Board of Nursing statute and rules versus what might be something that an employer doesn't look positively on but is not a violation.
So, okay. So you're referring to the issue that Ms. Jason referred to about changing it from policies to interpretive guidelines in their system. Mm-hmm. And you're not saying that the Board of Nursing is supporting employers or encouraging employers to use the Nurse Practice Act. You appreciate the fact that they're helping decrease the likelihood that employers will use that threat against nurses. Mm-hmm. I got really lost at the beginning, and I need to make sure I understood whether you were happy or unhappy about what was going on. So thank you.
Senator Steiner-Hayward, it's Monday morning. I'm happy.
It's good.
Nothing bad has happened yet this
week.
Okay,
good deal. Excellent.
However, what I would say is the answer is yes to two elements that I called out. First of all, and I didn't mention the changing policies to guidelines. I think that's very important because often you will hear somebody both in the nursing profession and outside saying it's against the law or it's illegal when there is no such statutory limitation.
Sure, that happens a lot.
Right. So I think our organization has appreciated the shift to guidelines. But what I was really referencing is the decision-making tool that the board has been working very hard on that would help any individual, whether it's an employer, me, you, a member of the public, make a decision whether this is something that warrants a report to the board or not.
Got
so
it.
That's really what I was specifically calling
Thank
out.
Thank you. Much clearer. Okay. Other questions
Thanks.
From Ms. King? Thank you very much.
Thanks.
I appreciate your coming to testify today. Anything else before the committee, Mr. Jelovet, co-chair? Okay. Tomorrow, I don't remember what we're doing tomorrow. What
are we doing? DHS starts tomorrow.
DHS starts tomorrow. Get ready, folks. All right. See you bright and early tomorrow morning. We're adjourned.